this meeting and I'd like to acknowledge the official Police Department of Fire, Education and Training, media, members of the public and other distinguished guests. Today's meeting is the continuation of the deliberations on the bill, clause by clause, and the committee deliberated up to the end of clause 24. And in this last meeting of the consideration of the bill on the 9th of March 2016. So today we will then start from where we left off. And it does look like we had the whole day, and I'm hoping that we will then make use of this quality time to make good progress on this before we close. And what makes me to talk about this issue, because I'm also aware of another bill that is supposed to be to come our way, so we obviously got to move this one out of our way so that we wait for the other bill that is on its way here. I'm talking about a bill that is appearing on the legislative program for 2016, where higher education and training has been allocated the National Qualifications Framework Amendment Bill, and this is supposed to be tabled in June to cabinet, and the date of introduction to parliament will be the 16th of July. So I'm talking about a program that is circulated, meaning that we do not have the luxury of time, we have to push. And if you look at this bill that is appearing here, it is one of the bills that the department on the 15th of September 2015 brief us on the number of bills that they will be introducing in this term, during this term. The Higher Education Amendment Bill is the one that we are busy with. There's the Skills Development Amendment Bill that is supposed to come before us before the end of the term. National Qualifications Framework Act 67 of 2008 is the one that is appearing on the cabinet legislative program to be able to cabinet and then and then table to parliament in July. Then the other bill is your amendment to continuing education training CETX. So these ones are the bills that, according to the department, are key legislation for the next 5 years, for the 5 years. So I'm trying to say we're keeping this information and we keep looking at it and using it to measure performance. So we really have to work harder and faster this time. I'm not saying we must compromise quality input, no, but at least if we can move faster. We reduce too much and then focus on real issues so that come end of this day, at least, you know, as if as this committee, we can adopt the bill today. You know, to me, to be a plus for us. I'm not saying we have, but if we can adopt it today, we can be a plus for us. So let's push an open way for other work that is going to come our way and work as high as we have been working and achieve as a committee and make the impact that we'd like to make. So with these two words, I once again welcome you and hope we will have constructive deliberations on the bill as we did with the previous deliberations. Thank you very much. So we will then move on to item number two, which is apologies. Are any apologies?
Thank you, Chair. You will receive apologies from Professor Kobisa as well as Mr. Mahumapilo. We also receive apologies from the Minister, the Deputy Minister, as well as the teacher. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, these are the apologies. We take note of these apologies. Honorable Member Hatta?
No, I'm not yet there.
No, it's a problem. Mr.
Now, thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to you and the members. Kindly note that I will have to leave the session at about 2 because we're presenting our ADP to the Select Committee on Education and Recreation. Thank you very much.
We also take note of this one. And any other apology? None. So we will then proceed with our agenda. We are on introduction. I don't think there's anyone who needs introduction. We all know each other. But just as a reminder, as you speak, just remind us who you are. Try to get used to the names and not honorable men or Mr. Sora, you know. All right, no, that's fine. Thank you very much. So we move on to item number 4, consideration of the Higher Education Amendment Bill, B36 of 2015, sorry, lost by law. So we are using the amendment bill, and we've got these other soft documents, remember the Principal Act, and also the same act that has got these amendments, that was
the track changes.
Come again?
Track changes.
With track, the act with track changes. Thank you very much. I think so, not only more than track. With track changes. Thank you very much. We are now on 24. Remember, we've done 24, so we're now on 25. Honorable members, 25. There are proposals there on the amendments. And then what is the take of the Honourable Member? Honourable Member, Professor Kozoli?
I just want to do with this. In the previous meeting, the same document was actually presented as a result of a joint effort from the parliamentary legal advisor, the federal advisor, and the department, and this document was presented. During the discussion, there were two amendments that were affected by this committee, and the clerk of the portfolio committee called me and asked if I can just incorporate it. It is relating to clause 10 and to clause 12.
Anile, what
did you say? And that's the only difference of this document dated the 11th of April than the one that says before the committee in the last meeting as joint effort from the members, the legal advisors. And what is there? No decision of the department. It was just putting it on a format which is in line with the bill and which is reflecting the decision, and it is in accordance with my notes and that of Anile. Thank you, sir.
Just in terms of process-wise, that we've been recording, we understood at the previous portfolio committee that we were going quickly through and flagging issues that could not be resolved, and this is one of the issues that I have flagged, that you then indicated that you're going to go back to all the flagged issues and have deliberations.
other report or information. And we believe that that is too broad. We would like that to be removed.
What is it actually removed?
Any other report or information.
Okay. But there's a proposal on the table on the removal of any other report or information.
You see, what I would like is that they must talk to me or talk through me. When you discuss alone, then I get confused. Then I have to wait for you to finish discussing, and it's going to help us actually. But then actually, we need to move faster. Raise your issue, it's okay. Put it on the table. Allow us to debate and then arrive at a conclusion on that issue. Honourable member, there's a proposal on the table on sub-clause. There's sub-clause A and then subsection 1 and sub-clause 1. Do you see that? Is it 1? Or is it sub-clause A? A, sub-clause 1.
1A. 1A.
Yeah.
A, 1A.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Yes. A, sub-clause 1 and sub-clause of sub-clause 1, A. All right, so that's fine. You have me. All right, so there's a proposal on the table.
Honourable
member,
I think we should maintain the form because it allows the department,
okay. There's a I think there's another proposal, there's a counter proposal. And then Honourable
my second economic proposal, and I will substantiate my position on the basis that if we again look at the principle act, the whole point of departure is on. Maybe it's just not, I should turn it up a little bit. If we look at the principle act, this section deals with financial impropriety, and I think if we do not expand the reference, then it could be a technical matter that some report is not provided if the minister needs that to determine the extent or if there is a case of financial impropriety. So thank you.
Chairperson, I really don't, and perhaps maybe the department can give us some information as to really what other information or reports there may be intention here. Because if something is a audited statement or formal investigation, therefore it has credibility and liability. You can rely upon that set of information that could expose any part of financial impropriety. So for example, the council initiates an investigation into something, and there is it's a report that comes from a formal investigation. It could be initiated by council, it could be initiated by anyone else that has the authority to conduct such investigations. It could be forensic in nature and so forth. Similarly, as per the audit reports or audit statements, such financial impropriety can then come to light in these circumstances. Now, when you expand this and you say, well, or any other report or information, the way I read it, Jefferson, is that, well, there could be information that's presented in the media that's it cannot be relied on. It has not gone through a formal investigation or has the credibility which comes with an audited report. And therefore, one could be acting upon something that is not properly verified, which I don't think, Chairperson, is the intention here. I really don't believe that's the intention. I don't believe we'd want to open up to that extent, because then anyone can be opened up to that extent. Anyone can make an accusation or allegation, go and write an affidavit and say, well, this is other information that is being presented which indicates financial impropriety in any institution. And therefore, all the following sections then kick into gear in terms of directors, in terms of administration and so forth, which I find very, very dangerous. I want to appeal to really considering what the implications would be in practical terms.
Okay, I'd like to allow advocate to come in.
Chairperson, just before advocate comes in, can I just indicate that the issue that I observed in the previous meeting also is we need to take into account the context of the amendments. So if you look at 25B, this introduction of 25A is a replacement for 25B. So the issue is that if you look at 25B, what has been deleted is in fact more onerous and whatever, so this is providing clarity around it. So I just want to indicate that if, for example, if this amendment, this addition is deleted, then the deletion must have come in again, because otherwise there is a substantive change. So in the original legislation, we did have any other circumstances arising that may be financial or other maladministration of a serious nature. So it is there in the current legislation. And that addition is basically to cater for that deletion. So the two must be read into together. The addition together with the deletion must be read together.
Okay, just allow...
Honourable, it is important also to remember that there are other pieces of legislation also playing a very important role in the public administration. It is important that the minister must follow this up and must use this in a proper manner. It can also come from this committee, where specific information is given and this is a minister to deal with it. And in that type of operation, it's going to be in a box for this, and it must be opportunity of minister when you deal with. And as a serious decision, it is a requirement by law and the Constitution that I must a clear rationale which is justified on the fact of that specific case. So it can't be a frivolous mentioning in a newspaper that can cause this severe litigation. And it's all important to note that when it comes to the appointment of the administrator, it is a long process. It is after and a intervention of a instruction being given, then the institution of a independent assessor, and this is just the final to that.
Okay,
thank you, Chair. I would like to align myself with the view that it is better to be more inclusive than to be exclusive, because we cannot, as a CTA, think of all the possibilities that may arise in the future. So a situation arises and we are blocked this year, and then people will say, now let's go back and amend the Constitution again. One can only hope that those that will be dealing with this business will be mature enough to realize that they need to consider whatever comes along. They will weigh it up and they will then consider it, and they will find that the Act allows it. It's not too exclusive. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you still on the floor? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add on before I get to the honourable members' question, I think it's important. Sorry, I just want to introduce myself. My name is Theo Hercules. I'm from the Office of the Chief Special Advisor, and I'm standing in for Mr. McLean, who can't be here today. All right. No, I'm an attorney. Thank you, Chair. Now, with regard to Section 25, the main section, 49B of the Principal Act, and 49B of the Principal Act provides for the appointment of an administrator. And like Mr. Boto said, there's already a process that has been probably undertaken to get to this stage. So all this is providing for basically is to indicate the circumstances that will lead to the appointment of an administrator. Most of it is already in the current Act. It's basically just a readjustment of the circumstance and to clarify those grounds. If you look at paragraph A, from lines 16 to 30, that's paragraph A to D, those are the circumstances that the minister then will consider. And then paragraph B indicates that the minister must then, before making an appointment for administrator, on the grounds listed in A or B, then there's a process that must follow. And that process is written notice must be given to the council of the higher education. The council must be given an opportunity to consider the reasons for the appointment. And also the council must have a reasonable opportunity to make representations. And then that will be considered as such. So these only relate to those circumstances for the appointment of an administrator to intervene and on those grounds. So that's basically the intention of the clause with the proposed amendment as is. Okay, so I just wanted to bring that to the committee as well, just to give a framework in which this appointment will take place, the circumstances and the process. That's basically what it provides for. Thank you, Chief. I hope I've answered the question of the honourable member as well with regard to under what circumstances will this, will section 49B as proposed, I will also be then applied.
Thank you very much. Could you just explain the meaning of the word and the phrase notwithstanding any other provisions of the Act, which seem to imply that it doesn't matter what else the Act says, you've appointed an administrator because you've got a document that says there was a little bit of fiddling the money.
In the tree of any document. So a press report might say that we believe there's something going on.
According to this clause, the minister would then appoint an administrator.
Thank you. Okay.
My name is Shepson and members. What I would like to add as well is if you look into the circumstances and the facts that are followed, if you read sub-clause 2 now, the minister can only invoke this provision when the minister considers this to be the only in the best interest of public. So I think it's also essential for us to just read the whole provision so that we understand the step. Because when we look into 2, it says the minister may only act in terms of subsection 1A or B. If he or she has reason to believe that the appointment of the administrator is in the best interest of the public education, therefore the consideration that steps to be followed, so the minister is not going to let us jump into that step, which is a follow up on what my colleagues have already indicated.
Okay,
I've got a problem sometimes with the input from special advice, because we ask one thing, then we get a different response. They got nothing to do with what we were asking about. What we were told is that all the steps must be followed, independent, etc., etc., and so forth, before you get to administration. Okay? And we then ask, as to say, as according to this wording, notwithstanding any other provision of this Act, the minister may go ahead with diabetes. Okay? Now, then we get a response now that says, well, if you look at subclause 2, the minister may only act in these circumstances if he has reason to believe that it's the best interest of public education. That's not what we're asking. We were asking in terms of all the steps that must be followed before you get here, not whether he has reason to believe that it's in the best interest of public education. So it's not answering our questions straightforward, Chairperson. So I've got a bit of a problem with that, and I'd like a straight answer in terms of whether or not, according to that wording, notwithstanding any other provision of the Act, the minister can just go straight to administration in terms of his sections without going through the other steps such as independent tests and so forth, which we were told earlier, unless we were being misled, that might go through all the steps before we ever get at the last resort. Chairperson, we just want a straight answer. It's got nothing to do with subclause 2 and reason to believe in the best interest. That's not what we are.
As long as in our engagement we move from a position of trust, I think all of us say we mean well. We really want the best out of this piece of legislation, and we are doing it in the best interest of the center, but also of the broader community out there. So that's fine. I think somebody sends up, who else, and then from there we must then remember to consider we are deliberating. I haven't forgotten your lesson, Professor Miller. Consider, deliberate, and resolve. So please help me to move towards consensus. All right? So who says that? Okay, Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think we must not just ignore the original, the mother. And if we look at that and we see what we have to accept that what is now proposed is an absolute improvement. Mm. Why is it? In the first instance, I see there's discomfort with the wording notwithstanding anything in the Act. Now, that is there. It is in the Mother Act, is still, it was there. But what is worse in the original Act is it was not a proper process. For instance, in the original Act, subparagraph B says, makes reference to any other circumstances arising that include financial or other maladministration of serious nature. So it's very broad, etc. And it just says, the minister may appoint an administrator if the following circumstances occur and enlisted, etc. Now we have a new provision in the draft before us, and that is that there is a process that must be followed. There must be written notification to the institution that he intends to do this, that, and the following. And then secondly, the last issue is the minister may only act in terms of that section if he is believing that that is in the best interest of education. It's not sort of a political sort of shenanigans that he's playing out. It is important that provision is also there. So those institutions that believe there is not bona fides on the side of the minister could in fact say on the basis of the new truth that the minister acted malaise or whatever. I believe, Chairperson, I really want to assure the DA that it is not that we also are not scrutinizing every word. Clearly we have to do that, all of us. But we should not read into it something that does not exist. So that's just my comment.
Honourable Member, so that your hand is up, but if you can assist me so that they can progress. So far we've been dealing with just clause 25, sub-clause 20. I'll have to move on to 26. Honourable Member Suela?
Yes, I think that this is a good intention, and therefore we have no reason to believe that there is an ulterior motive. But like Honourable Manga said earlier on, we are not in any position to predict the future, therefore we should leave room for starting a future so that we should be taken for in the bill. And I suggest that we retain the property.
Okay. now we have now adequately deliberated. They were sufficiently deliberated that we then move on to a consensus. Are we, there are two views on the table. The one that says must retain, the one that says we should not retain. So the, those that say we must retain,
Sure, I think we are not going to...
And you must be transparent.
Could we just
I can't be quiet here, I think. So
could we just know that there's not consent? We are happy with that. That's fair enough.
It's almost like majority agreeing with
you. No, it's not true. Consent is because everyone agrees. Yeah. Not consent. There are people who disagree.
But then we have about sufficient
I think what can make life a lot easier is you could provide a written schedule of objections with reasons as to why those objections. I think it will save us a lot of time. They have it to articulate every time and then have it recorded and might not be recorded as would want to be recorded.
Thank you very much. Shall we then move to
Now the trouble with subclause B is that it concentrates the circumstances in section 42 as one of the conditions for intervention. If you look at the last sentence, the circumstances concentrated in section 42. Mm-hmm. Now our problem with that is that we already are very concerned about 42 and we have submitted our concerns. So for this clause to depend on 42 is a problem for us unless 42 is amended. Okay, so we would like to note that unless 42 is amended, we object to the clause.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. We take note of that. Any other input? On B? On clause B? Sub-clause B? None.
Move
to sub-clause B. Yes,
Sure, and this is actually a departure from the Principal Act. This whole thing of he or she has reason to believe that.
No, that's the next step.
Now we'll see. No, we'll see now.
Are
we in sub C? Sub C.
When you just subclause C, I see that you talk about the subclause C after subclause B.
After which
the one
I object to was
the circumstances contemplated in section 42.
Yes. Line 25. Right, so now we're on our substance. Right, are you? Maybe can I just on the numbering here. Clause is in the bill, it is clause 25 that we are working with. And then you've got sub A, B, and C all at sub clause. Clause 25. And then in A, it is referring to a specific section, section 49B of the Act, of which there is a subsection 1, and subsection 1 got that A, B, C, D.
That's much clearer.
So when you are referring to a sub clause, it means it's the third line of A, B, C. When you are dealing with any of the others, then it is.
Yeah.
Sub A of section 1 of that is referred to in clause 25 sub A.
Well, thank you so much, because I was also getting really confused myself, and you had to be here to educate us about some of this. Thank you very much. Shall we then proceed? So we were dealing with not sub A, we're dealing with sub clause B, and then we moved to sub clause C, there's nothing there, sub clause D, nothing. Shall we then move to sub clause B?
C. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here we are, sub clause 25D. Yes. None. Shall we then move to sub clause 25C? Okay, Honorable Kasim? Yes, sub clause 25.
This is the point that I was articulating. That is a departure from that. It's not the first time that it has been raised in this process. I've raised it previously. This whole he or she has reason to believe that. It does make more difficult, I mean, I can't take legal advice, it does make it more difficult to overturn such a decision in the courts. Because all that has been proven is that the minister had reason to believe such and such a thing was in this particular interest, or such and such a thing was taking place, or such and such a thing was unfair. If you remember, that was the last time we discussed this matter, it was around someone being treated unfairly, if the minister had reason to believe that someone was treated unfairly. Not proof or not that person was treated unfairly, it's just that he had reason to believe that a person was treated unfairly. Now, in this instance, if he or she has reason to believe that the appointment of an administrator is in the best interest of a public education institution, Jefferson, my proposal is to say that can we remove that wording and keep it as it was in principle act? And that's my proposal.
Well, there's a proposal on the table. The minister has gradually over the years tightened his control of the university. And we see this act as another way of tightening the minister's control. And we see reason to believe as a very, very important dimension in the tightening of control. We are not happy with this. And we would like to be. Advocate Osho? Oh, sorry. Okay. Honorable member, Kinaka?
Sir, I'm surprised that this reason to believe is kind of alarmist. I can understand that, because just as a layman, I know that even though the conceptualization of a reasonable to a reasonable man is a common phrase. So if they say minister is a reason to believe, it means to a reasonable man. And in another like that, that it refers to a reasonable, it should sound reasonable to a reasonable man. And it is very common that I'm surprised that their lawyer has advised otherwise. So really, I don't see a problem because something is common practice to a lawyer.
Sorry, although I've got other lawyers who must then tell us, validate this argument, or,
advocate, today everybody's honorable, right? Yeah, other than Mr. Patel, I don't have aspirations to become honorable member. It is important also to remember that it is the minister who must take a decision in terms of the administrative law. It is the minister who must act. So he must have his own view, his own opinion when taking a decision. And he must take it on reasons that is justified. And a reasonable leave is actually referring to his obligation in terms of the administrative law in order to have a rationale for the decision, and he must justify it when taking that decision. Thank you, sir.
All right. Hello, Cindy. I wish to deliberate on this one. Honorable Mema Mkulu.
Thank you, sir. I want to support my colleague this side to say in this 25 things is ensuring reasonableness and again to ensure that the minister doesn't just act apathetically. This one must be kept as is. And it, to me, it says that the minister will be involved if he does act, given the force, given the law, he can charge if he doesn't act reasonably. That's one of the things. Because he can be in trouble again if he just as appointed administrator unnecessarily.
Okay. Shall we then, it's not resolving, conclude on this one? Do you still want to motivate why we should retain, we should remove?
I understand exactly what the advocate is saying. I do. I just believe, personally, Chairperson, it's not in the party political country, personally, that it's better, especially when dealing with autonomous institutions, it is better if these types of decisions taken by the minister are taken based on facts and not on his opinion or rationale in the particular circumstance. I just think that is an appropriate safeguard in this sector in particular. But having said that, Chairperson, of course, would like you to note this objection. And it was not just to this section, but to the previous ones if you recall as well.
All right, let's take note of this objection. And the fact that the majority agree with us. What is majority? Okay, then we move on now to clause 26. I pray that this one does not delay, like clause 25, but that's fine if you prerogate it, if you write vague issues until we arrive at a conclusion. Okay, clause 26, publication of appointment of administrator. A, subclause A, subclause B, subclause C, subclause D. Am I right?
Yes.
No.
No.
Okay.
The whole new insertion on its own.
Is it correctly? It is better at each time. Why do you say no?
So, Chair, again, the clause is only 26. There are no sub-clauses in there.
So, the A, B, C, what
is the those are subsections of the insertion.
Oh, okay.
Right. Shall we then move to clause 27? Now look at the agree with this clause 27. Let's move to clause 28. Okay. Quiet. Shall we then move to clause 16? So there's no objection there, so we move to clause 29. We have. I gave you time. You know what I did? I said clause 28 and you all kept quiet. And then when we're not talking,
There are no subclauses.
Yeah,
please,
okay. Shall we
re-engage it
again on this one? I think let me
attempt
to assist again. The way you look into the clauses, if you start by saying by the what part of substitution or by the deletion, then that means that's a subclause or a clause. For example, in 28, we have following is hereby inserted after section 49, which means that's just one, there's one clause there. But the previous one that we're dealing with, where we separated it, you have an A that says by the substitution of this, by the deletion of this, by the... So to give the discussion the A in the beginning, what are we doing on this one, what are we doing, are we substituting, are we deleting, are we adding, are we... I think that's a better way of explaining it. So this one is just a one clause with sub, I would say sub sections when it's done. Just look into that, and then if there is what if concerns or and all of that, then you can do that way. Okay, we've got clause and then subsection. But where is that by, then now you know that that is a subclause. Understood, eh?
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, this is simply just look at inverted commas.
Okay.
So everything in inverted commas is a whole section that you can't call that a clause.
Okay.
So if you look at the clause 25, you notice that A is not an inverted comma, so it's a sub clause of this document. If you look at clause 28, right, it starts with the inverted comma, so from where the inverted comma starts to where it ends is the whole clause. And within that particular part, there's a separate numbering.
All right. Let's practice a little bit better with the passage of time. All right.
So we now on clause 28.
Chief, just on the process again, maybe just to assist the committee further. Before you get to each clause, there's a heading of a clause.
Yes.
And in this case, we have under clause 28, it says insertion of sections 49F to 49J in Act 101 of 1997. So that means in the Principal Act, the following clauses will now be inserted. So each one represents the insertion, basically. So first we have a new 49F, 49G, and H to I and J. Those are the new clauses that we're going to insert. So they're not in the Act, they're going to be inserted. So I think what I propose is we must actually refer to each new section that's going to be inserted. So the first one under 28 would be 49F, dealing with the roles, powers, function, and duties of the administrator. That's the first one.
Shall we go back to 28
and we already discussed? Clause 28, let's look at section 49F. Yeah, I'm just wondering if we couldn't start with a sort of motivation for the insertion of quite a lot of new provisions into this clause, which I understand are intended to simplify the process and streamline it. In fact, the USAF, for example, welcomed many of these changes, saying that they would provide clarity and streamlining in the whole administrative process. I think it would help us to decide whether or not we like these insertions, just to have the time mental modulation. They may have done it before, but it was probably a long time ago.
Okay, and any response
I
proposal?
This was a request that came from the university sector to simplify the current provision. The current provisions refer to compliance to the administrative law. And the concern was that if it just by reference to the compliance to the administrative justice and the administrative law is not as clear and simple, and that they would rather want to see the different steps, the procedural requirements, and those legal prescripts that came out of the administrative law to be contained in this piece of legislation. It makes it easier for the minister who must apply his mind. It makes it easier for the administrator who must execute the function in order to know what is the so-called marching orders coming from Parliament in order to execute that function. And that is why it is so deliberate. It was developed in conjunction with the university sector, and that's why they also supported it when they made the presentation.
Okay, and
the
explanation?
Sure, I think we need to know then whether this simply repeats administrative justice law or whether it has elements in it that are unique to the circumstance.
It's not repeating the administrative justice law, but it is applying the principles of the administrative law in terms of the context of the specific operation.
I think it's about being clear about exactly what the role of the administrator is, so that what the Act does then is it shows what it is. Previously, the minister would put it into the grid. What it was that he expected the administrator to do. And those could change depending on all kinds of things. But yeah, it's now absolutely clear about what their role is.
Okay, another member, please. No, I'm not understanding, but I wanted to ask you this one here. You know, if you're looking at close 2018, as the state advisor says, you know, for 49F to 49G. So it means when we're dealing with 49F, there will be subsection 1. 1 yes. With 8 UCD and B. 49F 2. 49F 3. With the subsection. So it means that we must be able to meet this limit in collaboration with everything. There is this limit question because what we did with 25. If someone is referring us to the following that what is really, then it is viewed as incorrect. So we must be able to understand how to deal with this for sure.
Okay,
so now I'm closed.
I wanted to get clarity so that we can all meet for the same wavelength.
Prof, shall we continue? Section 49G. Okay. Section 49H. Section 49
I section.
It's
section. New section. Chair. Chair, on 49 I, we would like a clarity on this provision that you put an administrator into a university. They then have huge powers in order to try and rectify the problems in that university. At a certain point, their term of office is terminated and a new council is brought in. What this provision seems to do, seems to be saying that while that new council is operating, which I think is a three-year or something cycle, the minister can more or less tell it what to do. And this is concerned to us, if this is what is intended here, and I would like, first of all, some elaboration on that.
Elaboration on this session, what name I,
Dr. This is particularly comes from experiences of institutions under administration. What will typically happen is that an institution will be under administration. Enormous amounts of work would have been done in order to get that institution onto a new track. But now you have a situation where, and it's 2 years at the maximum, so it's a very short period of time. You're on a track where it is going. A new council comes in that generally has very little experience. And even if the former administrator or the department or the minister advises that council on how to handle what is happening, there's no ability for the minister to give directives, other things happen. And that is what has really gone wrong with most of the institutions that have come out of administration, and we've seen the kind of problems that are there.
And I mean, one of the cases in point is the injustice dividend.
We also have the same problem at TUT. It's something that, that has to happen. There has to be some directive that says the administrator has done all this work. This is the plan. You have to follow that plan. Otherwise, what happens is that the new council comes in and the old interests resurface, and that never really taken care of. You're dealing with a period of up to 3 to 5 years to actually deal with the real problems that were at that institution.
Thank you for that intervention, and then Honourable Member Hastings, and then Honourable Member Hillier.
Chair, I completely understand where Dr. Parker and the department are coming from in this instance. However, I mean, if you read into the way Section 49I is written, it doesn't speak about recommendations of the administrator. It doesn't speak about issues arisen from administration. It just says after the administrator has been terminated, and the first and within the term of office of the first council, the minister may, after consultation with that council, issue a directive to the council to take such actions that the minister has reasonable grounds to believe that certain matters related to the effective and efficient functioning of the institution. It's not referring to issues arising out of administration or recommendations of the administrator. It could be anything that the minister has reasonable grounds to believe, issue a directive to the council. Chair, why have a council in that instance? Because the minister will just say to the council, do X, Y, and Z, and therefore usurp the responsibility or the governance responsibility of the council in the process, which is totally defies logic in my opinion. Why have a council? That council is supposed to be charged with governance of the institution, and therefore leaving this backdoor open in the first term of the council after administration is counter to that principle in general. And therefore, I cannot agree with the section the way that it is written. Perhaps one could say that the recommendations of the administrator be considered by the first council or be compelled by the first council, whatever the case may be. But as it stands now, the entire mandate of the council is usurped in that it can be directed in whichever way the minister wants it to be directed. In effect, the council, the first council, has marching orders of what the minister wants it to do, and it must comply during its entire term of office, or at any point during its entire first term of office, that marching orders can be given. And therefore, I mean, I don't see a point in having a council in that instance, because why not just let the department run that responsibility if that's what they want to do. And that's my input, Chief.
Thank you.
I think we must just understand that the whole problem is There's no council, there's an administrator. The administrator investigates, determines what the problems are, tries to develop a recovery plan for the specific institution. Now a new council comes in, squeaky clean, new, inexperienced. Now that recovery plan will then be shelved unless it follows through from the minister to say, this is what we have found at the institution. Otherwise, Chairperson, I mean, that is why so many of the institutions fail. It's because you bring in the administrator, you clean up the operation, and you council comes in. I mean, in other departments, we see it daily. We've now seen it again in the annual plan processes, etc., and strategic plan processes. So I cannot agree with that. I think that is when, with great respect, when you're looking legally at the problem, instead of looking at it from a public management process of education, because there was a problem. The minister chopped their head, or the council finally resigned. There's no institutional memory. And if you don't compel the implementation of that recovery plan, you're going to have a failed institution going forward again.
Okay, yes, speaking from experience as well, the chief has been admitted. On his end, he has got to submit a report, a handover report that will be talking to all the issues that he has found, but also come up with a turnaround plan. And then he will not just go and leave it here on his desk. He will then go and brief the minister on a turnaround plan before his exit. Which means the minister will then be sitting with the thing on his exit. He will not be able to come and explain him to his exit. And then the minister will then take this and then must then instruct the council on the implementation of the turnaround plan. Or in business will say rescue plan. Right, I do want you to ask the chief to round up the discussion now so that we can move on to conclusion. Oh, I recognize Mr. Duella, and then yourself, and then Mr. Matt.
Chairperson, I do think that the purpose of this is to ensure that the work of the administrator doesn't go down in way. Because obviously, when an administrator is appointed, he or she has to right the wrongs. And when the new council comes in, it will be proper for them to know what has happened up to that particular point. And when they take over, they should proceed with the plan or the recommendations of the administrator. I don't think that the minister can issue any directives outside what else is just there. I think so. Thank you.
Chair, apologies for that. I agree fully with the substance of what Dr. Parker has articulated and what Honorable Gillian and Honorable Suella has articulated. The council should be compelled to adhere to and implement the recovery plan of the administrator. I agree 100% with that, but that is not what the section says. And therefore, what I'm proposing is that we amend the section to say exactly what Honorable Suella and Honorable Gillian is saying, is that the minister can issue a directive, we can word it that the minister may issue a directive if the recovery plan is not adhered to, or that the recovery plan or the council must be compelled to implement the recovery plan. As it stands now, there's no mention of the work of the administrator in terms of the directives that the minister would issue. It's not limited to the work of the administrator, the findings of the administrator, and the recovery plan of the administrator. It is completely flexible to anything that the minister would want to issue a directive on, if he has reasonable grounds to believe that it would that matters the effective and efficient functioning of the institution and the execution of its mandate
by specific or continued attention of the council and the management. And therefore, my proposal is exactly what Honorable Suella and Honorable Killian are articulating and what Dr. Park has articulated, to word it as such, as to say that the recovery plan should be compelled upon the council, or the minister may issue a directive in the event that the recovery plan of the administrator is not adhered to. So that would tackle the substance of the matter.
Firstly, in law, there is administrative activities, and then there is legal, what you call legal oversight. Now, under legal oversight, a directive is a legal instrument. A directive upon which it is questionable, because it can give the review in a what we call the review, and apply for it to as a counsel. If you feel that the kind, I'm just making an example, if you feel that the directive that the minister or the ministry is giving you is an illegal directive, it impinges on your activities, high school, secondary activities as a counsel, you can indicate to the minister that you are in fact intending to ask for review. Now, I'm trying to double check this. This, to me, looks like the basic way in which they're creating both the legal instrument to synthesize what is the expectation and post-expectation on administrator, but also, most importantly, we are trying to create a transition so that there is nothing lost between the activities of the transition of the administrator and the coming into office of the new leadership. Now, my experience tells me, which is what is quite familiar with what Honorable Janice is saying, more often, every candidate wants to think that they are a new candidate. They want to think that they have to deal and handle new issues. They want to assume that they have no relationship whatsoever with the previous horrible council. There is a connection. The connection is bringing governance to order. It doesn't matter whether they are a new council. If things went horribly wrong on the previous council, you still have to take a legal directive to correct the wrong. Because the institution is one. It's not made up of candles. The institution is made up of statutes. Now, I'm just trying to secure myself a situation where I'm quite aware of what is happening. But maybe somebody must assist Honorable Cassin for the breakdown of exactly what is it that maybe one of him.
Remember, you're not addressing one another, we are identity. We are deliberating on the clause sections and subsections. And I think you raised a very important point. And I know we come from your experience as a member of the council.
Right?
Sure.
In the past. All right. No, that's fine. Honorable Member Kevin and then Honorable Member Bozoli, help us to close this deliberation now, so we can move on to the next clause.
Chairperson, what would be helpful, I just wanted to motivate one additional reason, and that is that there is consultation between the minister and council, the new incoming council, because it's after consultation with them. Now, the only thing that I have a concern with is that we hear some of the objections that the DA is popular objections. They didn't want to have concerns. They have objections. But if they do that, it would help us if they could submit. But during the deliberation here, but maybe they don't convince us to. Maybe it's here and there a word, but why don't they come with the written proposal of how to amend it in such a way that it would, in fact, also get their support. That would be the first. But if we talk in general, we don't see this major problem. The DNC is this major problem. Now, how do we bridge it in such a way that we can maybe find each other on the map? And I don't want this to have to go back to the discussion, that's not going to help. Let us look at the wording and see, would it be possible for us to adopt them?
Word instead of what we have in the act. Thank you.
Okay,
maybe just one aspect. I need to the report. But the minister, it may be that he wants them to follow that. But there are other issues. For example, a new council comes in. And I mean, there are examples where new councils come in where very few members of the council have experience. They come in, and there's a real need and a requirement for council capacity changing, building. And the minister would advise the council to perhaps utilize the previous administrators to assist them in terms of that. To create the continuity between what was going on and what was there, and also to inform that council in detail on some of the issues that have been uncovered, so there could be a real understanding of it. Now, if it is put in the act that it's limited to taking forward a plan that's been put forward by the minister, it means that those kinds of issues can't come through. And in our real experiences with some of the institutions, the issues are much deeper than just the administrative financial issues. Some of it goes to the core of the academics in the institution. And there one would want, for example, to be able to work with council on higher education, to put in a team to assist the university to do something, whereas if the minister is not able to do that, the institution can refuse and the real issue of quality becomes a problem. So I think I would advise to be very careful not to limit the clause in terms of making it linked to a specific proposal. This clause was discussed in a lot of detail in the France team with the University of South Africa, and we also had workshops on it.
I think that clarified a lot of matters, and I think maybe it would have clarified to yourself to Angul Mbata as well, because his reading of it was to say, if you read it in the context legally, that's not the situation that you would get, but that's exactly what the intention and our understanding from the department is, Chairperson. No, Chair, I'm going to ask that we submit something, whether it is a different way of wording or a word here or there. And I want to make a proposal, Jefferson. If we read section 39I and the subsection C, after consultation with that council, issue a directive to the council to take such action as specified by the administrator's report in the event that the minister has grounds to leave or whatever. That would be the change. That we make, that is what we perhaps would deal with the issues post-administration, because I believe all substantial matters should be in that report if the minister has done his or her job correctly. The minister wants to advise further on any other matter. He has every right to do so, to advise. But when it comes to a directive, we shouldn't take such things lightly, as it directly impacts on the mandate of the council and governance responsibility in that regard. So therefore, my proposal, Chair, is that one amendment, as specified by, and instead of the minister in the event, would say the administrator's report in the event that the minister has union book comes to believe that certain matters related to the effective, etc., etc., It opens the door for the minister to issue a directive in terms of anything that is in that report of the administrator. That's my proposal, Chair.
Okay, I'm going to ask members of Taiwan if they are in this meeting. Professor Guzman?
Thank you, Chair. We have been informed that these clauses were brought in by the university themselves, but quite some, because they identified a lacuna in the act. So these are based on experience. Therefore, I fear to tamper with them too much. They felt they should give more powers to the minister. The suggestion is that the minister must be bound by what is stands in the report of the administrator. I don't know what the reasons were to empower the minister and not the administrator. So I would accept it as a thing because of the experiential background that I do not have.
Thank you very much.
I have a member of the
I do think we should modify the clause, this section. What the department is essentially doing is extending the period of administration. In a way. You're saying you've got your 2 years of administration, but we need a period after that to consolidate what the administration has proposed and found. And in effect, what you're doing, how long is the term council? 5 to 3 years. 5 years. So you're saying when a university goes under administration, it's a 7 year period, effectively. Because you're saying you've got 2 years of the administrator and then 5 years of the council being disempowered because the minister can tell it what to do, basically. So the declaration of administration has become a much more serious matter, even, than it ever was. It comes from a 2 year period to a 7 year period. And our feeling is that is extreme. That is extreme. You're effectively making it a 7 year period. And I think it also gives them a blank check to decide anything. The council can do anything that the minister deems necessary. The council effectively is not really a proper council. In fact, it shouldn't even be called a council. It should be called an interim council or something, because we're looking at a very, very dramatic change in the nature of university autonomy now. By putting a university under either an administrator or the minister's control for 7 years. And my feeling is even modifying this clause might be too harsh to the principle of university autonomy. And I would suggest we, at the very least, we modify it to include some reasons to what the administrator has found, to bind the minister and limit the amount to which he can control the students. So I'm not happy with it as it stands.
Thank you. Also, can you please send me a power by
the Yeah, no reference to 7 years. So, yeah, but yeah, the even in the text, it is linked to a specific wording that it must be reasonable. What would be the logic, what would be the reason to continue with it? The minister is here a director in order to ensure the effective function of that institution. It's not broader than that. It is direct to a specific difficulty. The administrator don't have the foresight or the inclination to know what will happen when the new council takes office and takes a different direction. It is only when that happens that the minister must have a tool, something to steer that council back onto the pathway again in order to avoid another administration. So, as soon as there is a director, there must be a rationale to the time frame as well. It is not an open-ended that it is for the duration of that council. It is purely to direct that council to get back to the good systems, the good practices, the good intentions that have been brought into that institution in order to give it maximum functionality and effectiveness. Thank you, sir.
I have an experience of having been to a council. Let me just explain how this transition happened. You have a 4-year term of office, project mission. You have a 4-year, some councils, majority of them have a 4-year term, maximum 4 years. But people pick and choose during the beginning of the first mission of council, some might be a quantum of 3 years. And then they allow for a transitional situation whereby majority becomes the 4 years. But this is how you implement a ministry. I will not say a minister, because sometimes people are fearing an individual. A ministry's directive. You distribute the requirements of the directive according to the committees of council. Respectively, there are between 4 and 5 committees of council. Majority of the issues addressed and requested by the ministry will be put in under audit, finance, and it maybe they have dispute, what you call dispute resolution or dispute mechanism, or sometimes change management between HR and dispute. What then happens is each of those committees, in order to implement a directive, they set up a program of action for the duration of what they assume is possible to resolve the matter. So it may not be 7 years, it can even be 18 months. Dependent on the agendas of the various committees of council, how they report to council from time to time on those issues, and on the speed of the executive in resolving. So it means you then tend to impose on the executive task additional duties to resolve certain things, but it gets reported to council. It never gets into a full term, because ordinarily, the council still has to go on with its business. These may not even be 10% of the issues of the council, by the way.
Okay.
That's me signing off.
Okay. Signing off the wrong way. Remember, I said, I'm trying to add a second point on this one. There are two other files. So you shall not agree, Mr. Sweller? Proposal replacing me from the administration.
I don't agree with that.
Okay, we agree with the proposal on the blockchain. Right? Do you agree with the proposal? Okay, sure. All right. Obviously, it's obvious. After the long explanation and experience,
Honourable Member, thank you, Chairperson. I do not agree with it, and I want to motivate. I do not agree with the proposal, and I want to motivate. What we're essentially doing is that we're now saying the minister must abdicate his political responsibility for public higher education institutions, because he must be sort of managing them from a distance. There was a serious problem there. There was an administrator, etc. Now a new council comes in. There's a possibility that things can go wrong again. But now, let the new council only apply at what was contained in the administrator's report. Maybe other things were also now coming to the fore. So clearly, the minister has it's like a stepchild. There must be a sort of a relationship giving direction to that institution that is very weak still as far as governance is concerned. So you cannot say that the minister does not have a responsibility in this exercise. He has a direct responsibility. And in fact, the DA will be first to demand that he accepts responsibility if that institution fails again. So I cannot concur with the wording, and that is in short the decision.
Can you go for this?
I support the retention of the clause as it is. The reason being, the one professor mentioned it happening to me that Vice Chancellors themselves from experience have proposed this. And it comes to me, I think we're strengthening it and we're swelling it, so I would really just retain it as it is.
Mr. Chairperson, I disagree with the proposal, and I agree with the professors and also propose that we look on. Okay, right, I'm not going to make the rules.
It's been mentioned by two. Thank you, Chairperson. It's been mentioned by two honorable members. Perhaps I misunderstood the department. I just wanted to put in clarity. Why did the vice chancellors of the university that proposed the section as is, or was it that they were just consulted with? And that's just the clarity that I want.
Yeah, this was a proposal that was introduced as part of the team by Professor De Beer, who's been a former administrator, and also in full support of the committee that has been assigned by USAF to assist in the drafting of the. And this was their wording as well. It was not the department for sure.
Chairperson, I'm sorry to delay the process, but the question that I'm having as we're deliberating on this is the report of the administrator. I've looked into the provision, unless I miss it, I'm sure the department can assist me. I don't see it mentioned anyway. And my question would be not in the proposal. So didn't there be a consideration of not even, I don't necessarily say the minister should take everything that they consider or something, mention somewhere of the report of the administration. Shouldn't that be relevant for the purposes of this provision? Maybe the government can ask me that, I should say.
Who is going to respond?
Yeah, maybe before the third driver also come in, I think it is just important to know that the intention is not for the minister to invoke this provision from the very start. It is the minister may do it if there is a reason for that. And if you link it to the administrator's report, it means that all administrators will therefore make a recommendation on how they perceive the new council will work and what problem they might incur when exercising their function. And it is very difficult to anticipate that different councils will act exactly the same. But it is important that when this is an intervention, the word reasonableness is a very important word in this provision. It deals with the specific position at that council, which it functions within their responsibility. And it is to direct them in order to avoid any further steps that might exist. It is not as a general provision that all administrators will lead to a council that is not following good sound practice. It is to deal with exceptional situations, but to avoid the ultimate of further administration.
Okay,
thank you, Chief. I've heard the submissions by the honourable members, and I hear the reporting that these are exceptional circumstances. But I think what the submission is that what about the administrator's views on pool? So maybe as a proposal, and maybe for the committee, maybe to consider is that maybe we can add the word after taking into account the administrator's report. So that's part of the minister's decision-making process here to ensure the effective, efficient functioning. So not specified as such, but after taking into account. So that means the minister's taking into account the report, whatever findings the administrators come to take that into account in issuing directives in this regard. That's more or less taking into account the submission to the concern of the honourable members. you know, regarding this particular matter. That is just a proposal, Chair, on my part.
Okay, where do you see us teaching that? Just before
me, Chair, we say issue a
direct.
Yeah, maybe to take such action after taking into account the administrative report. We can add it. We can come up with a proposal for the committee.
We can add it after the consultation.
So we can make a proposal at this stage. In the same, the minister, comma. After taking into account the administrative report,
yes,
and then continue.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
It sounds correct because if you have achieved, say, from the experience, whatever, this person will hand over for the test. And then, as a new person comes in, you can start making the report. But we need the experience also, we can also give the test for other reasonable issues. Now all other people work on delegated
power. So
I think this advocate, are you
still crafting? I've already read it, but Honorable Chair, it's in the theme of 49I, sub 1, it reads the minister may, before the word may, the minister and then the interest, after taking into account the administrator's report, and it continues may, and then A, B, and C. So
Okay, you read the letter, you can look at it, and then we're not starting the debate of fashion. There's a proposal that I think is perfect, it's taken at home.
Drafters. the very people who drafted this amendment, they helped us to unlock, we were actually reaching a stalemate. So they've helped us. So I'm saying, I'm not then going to say, I'm not going to allow me to speak. I'm not going to say, these ones because, no, remember I'm a guide as a chaperone. I'm a group. So we all looked at this and we debated from different angles. And I'm saying all of you have got your entitled opinion. But at the end, considering all the contributions, we have now arrived at a conclusion that this would be in the best interest of this piece of legislation, not of individuals, to include the administrator's report without removing the minister. Mm. So you can see that this one it's not compromised position, but you can see it's new and fresh, and it has to say to move forward. Shall we move forward? What are you still talking about, Kevin? Because we have now concluded that this is the way we should. Remember, we are about this clause, not about opinion. This clause. So we have now agreed on this clause, on how we go to. I want to talk about the clause. Mr. Swear, I want to talk about the clause. In the clause. Yeah, because remember, this meeting, the court is not this meeting now. Go clause by clause. Okay? And then arriving at a consensus on this clause so that we can at the end help adopt this piece of legislation. Alright? Ms. Killian and then Mr. Suena.
Chairperson, on the clause.
Yes.
On the clause, I'm going to stop.
Yes. On the clause. Why we support this, the new suggestion, it is more progressive in that it is not limiting the minister to only work from the administrator's report.
You made it this point.
It is now saying taking into account. So I just feel it's unfair to have to cast the version.
We
apply our mind.
Thank you. Made a very good point, Mr. Sweller.
And also this was brought by the state law advisor. You see, that's why they're here, so that they can guide us all the way. So thank you very much. I'm very happy with this. Shall we then move on to, we are now 49 days. Is there anything on 49 days?
Chair, I'm afraid we haven't said we agree with this yet. We still would like to reserve our rights on this one.
What is the right?
Our right to object at a later stage. We're not.
What are you objecting to?
We're not sure. I'm not sure whether I agree with the.
All right. We have at last chance when we adopt it.
Exactly.
Think about it in the meantime.
But I just don't want to apply your mind with consent.
So I mustn't say there was consensus, but also there's no objection. But there's no objection as well. So what do we have?
I don't
think this is out. Sometimes, you know, we like doing it, but fine. Shall we then proceed? From where I am sitting, there is consensus. Remember, I'm new to attend. I've tried to do it. You can't dispute it. From where I'm sitting, I've listened carefully, and then of course considered also your views. But then I think the person who took a step was where, as I've put it, we were reaching a stalemate. And then the state law advisor took us out of the stalemate. So we then move on to 49A. Section 49A. Nothing. Shall we, now that we move on to clause 29? Clause 29 has section 49K. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I told you. I said practice. We'll say everything right. Can't be touched,
In British commas, I'm not saying.
Yeah. And then section 49L. Section
section 49M. And I'll move to section 49N on section 49N. Yes.
Okay. I'm just interested in serving two consecutive terms. So there's a 4-year term, and then they may serve for another 8 years.
Serve a maximum of 2 consecutive terms.
So that is something that Mr. Mm-hmm. Mbassa alluded to earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Okay, yes. Okay, thank you very much. We now move to section 49O.
An objection under section 49B.
V.
V.
Yes.
V. That should be our item, correct? Yes. It refers to the provisions of section 42 to 49J, applied, etc. It's on the basis with the objection that we raised under section 42 that I just wanted to support the objection under 49V.
You think V or E?
Okay.
There's an objection. We take note of the objection by Honourable Member Kassim. Supported by Honourable Member Professor Pozzoli. Shall we then move to section 49W? We then move to clause 30. Clause 31.
Yes, sir.
Advocate?
Sir, it is important that the Honourable Committee does consider the document that was of proposals from the department, right, which is specifically dealing with clause 31.
Okay, shall we want us to refer to this document?
Yes.
Shall we look at this document?
Clause 31.
Clause 31.
It's very kicked off the document.
Yes. On page 20 in line 45, to only describe it. So you're taking us to section 45.
It is clause 31, which deals with section 51.
Oh yes, I see that one. Do you see? I don't remember. The 31 seems this, and then here they are saying on page 20 in line 45 to omit private. Section 51 of the principal act is hereby amended by the substitution of the heading authority to provide private higher education.
can you explain to that member how to clarify that one?
Here the issue here is this is dealing with the broader concept of higher education such. It is a private provider that has the authority to provide not private higher education but higher education in that as a private institution within that sector. And
in
therefore
higher education.
Indeed, yeah, and therefore it is not making sense.
So the proposal that we omit private, in that there's a line there that is authority to provide higher education, we omit private. Does it make sense? Mm.
So, no, you've made my morning.
This morning we really have been arguing and counter-arguing, but this one is so easy. Thank you very much. So you capture it accordingly. Mm. So this one we take. Alright. Come
again? Yeah. Alright. Please don't touch. Okay, that's fine. So then move to close a... That's the first, the three issues that's been raised.
Okay. Let's concentrate again. Maybe we reach consensus again.
The next issue is dealing with an amendment which is linked to sub-clause 31D, and it is the amendment to subsection 1 of section 31. The important thing here is that the authority to provide higher education when it comes to your private providers, it is linked to the constitutional principle and the constitutional right contained in section 29 that you've got a right as long as you comply with the requirement that is set for a comparable public institution. The current legislation accepted the principle that there must be a legal personality that applies. It can't be a natural person because it must consist of a governance structure and specific structures within that legal person in order to comply with what you would find in a comparison to a public institution where you've got a governance and management and different structures within that person in order to deliver on higher education. So with the original draft, that really important concept has actually been deleted in and supposed to be deleted and it was a mistake. It would have been a deviation from the principles that is laid down in the Constitution, and therefore we ask that it be retained. So the language that is proposed is basically to amend it, but also to provide in that it is no local juridic person or foreign juridic person, so that the concept of a juridic person and not a natural person is the criteria within which the authority is provided. And then it is basically dealing with the responsibility that has been contained in the current legislation to a large extent. So it is less often an amendment to the current legislation as was originally proposed.
Well, there is a proposal coming from the advocate, and I'm now referring to the member to consider. Honourable Member Professor Bologna, Honourable Member Mbaka, and Honourable Member Stevens.
Chair, I'm actually
I'm not sure whether you're only talking about one, because my query is actually under two, the insertion of and phrase and occupation. But maybe we should finish on one first.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
We have time to. So for now we are on one.
Chair, I think I agree with the first question. In fact, this is one of the things we were going to support for Catholic, because one of the very basic instruments of making sure that your system is not questionable anywhere in the world, it is to make sure that your system is founded on basic conditions. For instance, one of those conditions is that anyone who establishes an institution within a system must be properly and authorized institution. It must not be an individual. And most importantly, they must have certain figures. One of the things I said in the previous incident is that those figures are, for instance, what you would call an academic board, or among other things, the Senate. So that you make sure that the individual who sees higher education as an enterprise does not become a law or a law to itself or to itself. If he has got an enterprising view of the higher education, he must subject himself or itself into the founding of an institution, which will then collectively spread the rights and the requirements of an institution.
No, Chairperson, I think it is important, given the experience of the department, that they saw that there was a sort of a right, a so-called right in the Constitution, except that that right is not an unlimited right. And by rephrasing this section, I think we really... We in fact give the right meaning to who can expect to run a private higher education institution or a higher education institution that is not a public body. So I think this works.
Okay. I know that any law should be consistent with the Constitution. Now, shall we be associated then with in the Constitution, I think it's clause or section 29, 1B. No, I'm talking about section 29, 3. Can you look at that one and then ask myself?
No person with education is in here, so it's an effort to say.
Okay.
It says no person can provide education and let us register for the church. Is that the one person for the church? Oh.
Session must be read in the obviously as a whole, and it is important when you are reading session 29 sub 3 that everyone has the right to establish and maintain at its own expense independent education institution that does not discriminate on race or religious group of state, and maintain the standards that are not inferior to standards comparable to public institution. And so that is exactly the provision I was referring to earlier on, and which actually takes out the interpretation that it can be a natural person, because a natural person can't function like a legal entity or a legal person. And your institutions, your education institutions, must have a specific
characteristic which comes from those public institutions, and that is why it is required that we continue with the current solution and their amendment as proposed.
Okay, thank you.
Over to you, Honourable Member.
Honourable Member,
yes. Can I just say, at first reading, one feels that maybe this is sort of not correct, constitutionally not sound. But if you listen to advocate Robert's reasoning, and if you in addition also study Section 56, the limitation of us, then it makes good sense. It is specifically the importance of the purpose of the limitation. You know, I mean, if you read 29 in conjunction with specific, which is the limitation of life, then it must be reasonable for a specific purpose, and I think it just goes down well with it. Thank you.
So what's your view on the proposal?
No, I think we should support the proposal, Shepard. And I also just have clarity. Is this document a document that was compiled by the legal team within the department as well as the state law and sciences, or is it just a departmental document?
This is a document in which we've also discussed in that meeting. We've before the previous meeting, the 14th of March in that week, and it was a proposal that presented from the departmental side, but it was part of the document that we jointly developed the three sets of legal minds.
Okay,
the last time, that
was okay, don't try. That would be like your concern. That's very actually. That's a very end. Okay. Alright, so the concern is shall we then move on? Okay, on page 21. Alright. Let me check the honorable member. Page 1 we are fine there. Okay? Page 2 we are fine. Then
under one, there's also a sub 3, which is on clause 31, which is on page 21 in line 8.
It
provides that in the paragraph C by the substitution of subsection 2, and in that one the issue of the sub-framework being changed to sub-frameworks of higher education and also creation occupation. So, and it is dealing with the legislative requirement as is contained in the Inquis Act, the Net Qualification Framework Act, and also in line with the requirements of the white paper when it comes to the offering of a trade occupational qualification, which is a responsibility for the university sector to deal with the sort of qualification in that regard.
Okay, so
there's
a proposal
to the table. I know you wanted to come in for Sophia Havana. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't sure why trade and occupation is actually included in a higher education provision.
I'll be explaining.
I can explain it as well. The issue is that 1 Corinthians 29 of the Constitution provides that they must be, you can provide any education as long as it is registered with the state and it complies with the criteria comparable to the public institution. And there's never been a tradition which compels a private institution for the registration that is required in terms of the legislation. And the reason for that, there were no public comparability institutions to implement that revision of the Constitution. With the white paper, it is now made clear that your public identified university, public university, most probably the University of Technology, and your public colleges, your senior colleges, will be a comparable institution that will be used when it comes to the exercise of the right to Section 29. And it's for that reason that the revision has been introduced.
Thanks for the explanation. We now move to...
Sorry, Chair. Yes, yes, Chair.
Okay.
I just want to remind members that, remember, this is the third one that we did. And the process was that the Chair allowed us, and Honourable Dustin said we mustn't sleep when we come to these amendments. So, it was one of the previous meetings. So in that section 2, there's an addition to 7B and C would apply. So we're adding A and C.
I have no intention of being using the comment, but I just wanted to make it clear that whatever we define as an assimilated public higher education as the newly defined as meaning whatever that was added, it also means that the similar equivalent, if they are started by private providers, applies. You remember initially we generated a new understanding of what will constitute the making of a higher education institution. You gave us all those newly added. So I just want to make sure that everyone is compatible with that, so that we don't have a situation where somebody assumes that private providers will not go through the same phases. So it applies equally to all of them. Do you understand, Mr. Chair?
Okay. Shall we then move on to clause 33? I'm now moving on to clause 33. Clause 34.
The clause 33 is currently, as it is referring to a college, and it is if you look at
in line 33 on page 21. it is in particular categories of institutions which, in accordance with the regulations, and the issue that we are raising here is that there is now a change that it will be according to a specific or they call a right to deal with a college, a higher education college, or a different type of institution. And the reference in paragraph or in line 33 is to take out the old concept and to instead, because you've got already the concept of the university college, and then you've got a higher education institution, but it is actually a higher education college as the new terminology that is used for that institutional type. So it is just to correct the language there.
Chair, I'm just wondering what the implications will be then for our objection to these new terms not having been properly defined or applauded.
Chair, look, the issue is, if there's a contestation on the definition, an objection on the definition, wherever that term is used, the legislation should be taken as part of the original, because it's the definition that's contested. So it will be contested here also. Because later on it just becomes a term in the legislation rather than an action. And so the substantive one is definition. So the implications are that generally the clause may be fine, except for those things related to the definitions that were objected to.
Again, and it is actually it is not section the reference to section 3 sub 1 is incorrect. It should actually be section 3. It should not be 3c. It should be 3 sub 1 as the correct reference. And then also there is reference to section 20 sub 5 b, which is incorrect. In the document we provided, there also unfortunate typo there. It is it refers to section 25 capital A, which is also incorrect. It is sub 4
There is no 5(8). So, if we can ask the committee to consider that the references does be changed. So it is a reference to section 3 sub 1 and 20 sub 4. It is the proposal that a new sub 3 be included, which is important. It is an issue which is, if one goes to the provisions that section 35 is dealing with section 65 AD, which is in the Act, and which is a provision which is in the chapter, in the general chapter, and it is providing for the higher education institutions and how they operate and deals with it within that context, and how it is the scope and the type being amended. And what we've now proposed is that in that paragraph, that the provisions of step 1 and step 2, which is a new intention in the Act, will have the necessary implications also to your private institution when it comes to those institutional types. And that is why we say that these provisions will also be applicable to the private, obviously with the necessary changes attached to it. In the old days, they would have referred to it as part of the standard.
Can I just have clarity from the department? Why is it that if we look at the Constitution, reference is made to independent educational institutions? Why is it that you have adopted private instead of independent? I mean, not that it's a major transplant, but I was just wondering, is it not important for us to in fact follow through from the Constitution?
Okay, it might be a answer which is is coming from the history. Way back in the 1996, and I've been involved in that process also, so I can speak of institutional memory. The white paper at that point in time investigated the different terminologies with the school sector. It used independent schools. And at that point in time, the advice has been accepted that when it comes to your higher education institution, that it is the same terminology that was used internationally of a private institution. At that point in time, there were no private higher education institutions at all. But because of the globalization of university sector, it was agreed at that point in time to keep the terminology that is globally accepted for independent institutions, and that's the reason why it was adopted at that point in time.
There's nothing in law that is problematic. I mean, since we are now just cleaning up the, you know, and in fact reviving the higher education world, it's not necessary for us to look at.
Thank you very much. So we move to...
Chair, I just need the guidance from the committee because my notes do indicate that 65AB, section 65AB, subsection 1, that there was a change just in the order of the words. It says the minister may, after consultation with the CHE and at the request of council of the institution concerned, my notes say that there was a proposal that said the minister may, at the request of the council of the institution concerned and after consultation with the CHE, then by notice. So I don't know if anybody else has got it in the notes, but I know it came up from the committee in our first reading. No, I'm just looking for guidance today. This is what my notes show. This document here. That's what you were suggesting in red. But I see it's not in the amended the clause by clause thing. So I'm just saying whether it's still an issue or whether that word should stay.
I support Honorable Chair. I think the idea of private, irrespective of what was the intended meaning in 1986, consistent with the Constitution, we should bring back the word independent. Because we don't know what was preoccupying those regimes there in 1986. Maybe the plan was to stimulate the enterprise aspect of starting a private higher education. But I think we've grown that, we institutionalized it. What we are doing now with the Act is to regulate. So I think we must not be too romantic to think that we can still change. I don't think there's a special commitment to that word kindness that can make or persuade us to commit to the continuation of the word private. I think we understand, the era means. To me, the most important thing here is that our era has seen different things. And our era must now work on legalizing the best way possible. These are two different eras. The other one was stimulating. The other one accept that there's reached a level where in most likelihood it needs regulation. I don't know if I'm talking too much, but I don't seem to be very committed to this old era thing. If it were to really understand our situation now. I understand, but we have to move swiftly now in our situation. You go back to the era things again? You go back to 96?
What I tried to say, I try to explain where it came from. I don't think I persuade myself that it is inconsistent with the Constitution. In my view, it is consistent. It might not be using the express language of an independent, but independent and private got the same meaning. It means that it is independent from the state, or from a public private is also the opposite, which is not in the public domain but in the private domain. So it is not that there's been a specific connotation or an era attached to it. What I'd like to express was the international practice which the Constitution also referred to. The Constitution also provides that one must look at international practices when you interpret in provision within the Constitution. And that was the advice that came out of a ministerial commission which actually advised the white paper that has been adopted by government.
And we followed that approach of the white paper, which is a policy framework within which the consistency with the Constitution is very important and has been accepted, but it also provides a framework within which the legislation is then drafted and couched, and this is why it is
Sir President, my view would be the important thing would be for the committee to look into if you're looking into changing it. You need to go back to there's a definition in the Principal Act that defines what is a private education institution. To look into that definition and see if that definition satisfies the constitutional provision, which in my view it does. But if the committee is of the view, then it means consensually we need to go back to where it is used everywhere in the bill and see the impact. But if you change that, because in the proposed in the bill as it was presented to the committee, that definition was not changed and all of that. So the consequence would be then if you change this, look into all the constitutional amendments, start with the definition and change the definition, because the definition is different in the Principal Act. So I always have to read it vis-a-vis the Principal Act per person.
Okay, you see, it was not the whole Warner's list that I want to open. I just want to make sure that because we are becoming very explicit about what is a local juristic person, etc., etc., and it is based on that section of the Constitution, and the Constitution refers to independent institutions. I was just wondering, and I was posing the question, would we find ourselves in a difficulty that it is a sort of a mishmash, or is it okay, are we still founded on the Constitution by using the reference to private instead of independent? That's actually the essence.
Okay.
Yeah, no, okay. Look, there's two arguments in this. The one is a semantic argument of whether it's good to call something private or call something independent. So that's a semantic issue. But in terms of the legislation, if you go to the definition in our Higher Education Act, we define a private institution as a registered with a department. And the word registered is a link to your constitution, because whatever, independent or whatever you need to say, education, providing education, must be registered with the state. So we only recognize registration and we call it private. And that's the link to the Constitution, is the registration.
Simply because our concern was, are we not going to cripple ourselves, going forward, the people that are in the department to fall.
Section 35,
without the section 35, but it is the new clause that we are now providing is an amendment to section 65 capital B, which is in the Act for the moment, and there we add a similar sub B, which is also linked the provision that of the name change and institution name also to private institution when it comes to the revoking of the qualifications that have been indirectly provided for, which is linked to the public institution.
There's a proposal for
the new sub clause 3. Yes, in the document you will find it.
Provision of section 1 and 2 shall apply to register private and higher education institutions subject to necessary changes required by the Okay, agreed. Okay, thank you very much. And then 36. From the department, we are also proposed out.
It's the same concept.
Sorry, there's a new clause to be covered.
We've covered the new clause.
Yeah. So 36 is right, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to. I'm just doing my memory saying, I'm not sure if we have debated this point already. Under clause 36, on the base subsection A, 1A, on the basis of a material error on the part of the public higher education institution concerned, provided that such withdrawal and revocation may only take place within a period not exceeding 2 years after the conferment concerned. Now, I have a problem with that. Why limited to 2 years? I understand that it may be a material error on the part of the institution itself, but it doesn't mean that that person all of a sudden just becomes qualified because it wasn't that person's error, and that because 2 years has now passed, number one. Number two, I'm not sure if it could open up a loophole where people can get qualifications through if they are corrupt administrators at institutions, and it can be made, it can look like it was done erroneously after 2 years the qualification stands. So that's just a concern that I want to raise, Chairperson. I think we should remove the 2 year limitation, because if a person should not have gotten a qualification, whether it was their error or not, they are still not qualified. And I wouldn't want a person to represent themselves to me as qualified if they're not qualified. They should then have to go back and do what necessary to get qualified for the conferment of their basis.
Okay, to me there's a difference between an error that is made by the basis
and fraud to the conferment. All right. Yeah, no, Chair, I think the committee took substantive discussion, and as the Honourable Kesson wasn't present. The issue was on statute of limitations. The issue is, if an institution, the institution made an error, we're not talking of fraud unit, there's another section 60, 65, whatever that deals with it. But the issue is then, the question is, what's the alternative? Do you pursue a person who has unwittingly and unintentionally pursued a career, did further studies in masters, got employment, etc., and because of an error made long ago by an institution, that must be reversed. So the issue is errors and omissions. This is about errors and omissions should have to be accepted because it's not material and substantive. But what you're saying is that if it's within a 2-year period, at least the university has a right to correct it. But after that, you need to let it go. So that is, so the issue is that how far do you pursue it in terms of an error by the system itself rather than fraud by the individual?
I think the gentleman coming from honorable country had more work, whereas this has got no intended growth.
Okay.
What is fraud is fraud. Chairperson, I understood the explanation before I even spoke. I'm not mistaking fraud for something that was erroneously done. And therefore, my concern still remains if the committee feels otherwise, that their prerogative, as long as that concern can be noted.
Just from having worked in universities for a long time, my sense of it is that the kind of error we're talking about is something like students get 48 for statistics 3, and it's erroneously given as a pass, or this person is given a degree erroneously, although they pass everything else. In other words, we're talking about minor errors, which occur probably once in 5 years in any one university. It's a very rare thing, and it's often very minor, a very minor thing. Could we not slightly modify this to take count of the minor errors that may have been involved? Because I think what people might be thinking is that this is about someone who a university thought they got the degree, and in fact they actually failed every subject. But that is not really how it happens in real life. It's usually some sort of minor thing like they weren't meant to get credit for this, but they got credit for a bunch, you know, by mistake. So maybe if you somewhere introduce the word minor or due to a minor error, due to a small error. If the error of the university was to give a whole degree to somebody in which they failed everything by mistake, that should be able to be revoked forever. This really refers to minor errors.
Okay. All right, shall we be assisted to include the word minor? I don't think it's...
Chair, we absolutely compared with one another and we were of the opinion it can create a major interpretation problem. With minor, where would you draw the line? As 1, 2, 3, 5, it is, you can say, is it insignificant? That's another possibility. But the difficulty is always is it still an error which was caused by someone else and the system obviously is functioning in a manner which is bona fide. It is a mistake made, it is made in bona fide, and therefore one deals with it. With fraud it is a different issue because there's no limitation on fraud. It never prescribes. But when it comes to any other, there is a limitation. And if an institution can identify an honest mistake within a period of 3 years, fine, correct it and deal with it. It is the consequences of that is obviously being confined to a mistake which can be rectified within that specific time frame. But if it is open-ended and it is linked to a specific description, like small, insignificant, or that type of thing, it is just open for contention and it will create more harm than good.
So you are happy with that explanation? So if you agree. So then move on to the inclusion of sub-13, 3 and 4. Are you in agreement with that?
Yes.
Sub-13, 7.
Chair, what we understand is happening here is that in the Act, if a university wants to offer qualifications at a TVET level, it can apply to both. The minister has to agree. Here it says the minister can force the university to offer a TVET college if he so wishes. And we are very strongly opposed to that. It could lead to a change in the very nature of university, and they're not sure what the motivation is behind it. So we find it puzzling, and we're not happy with it. USAF were not happy with it. UDT was not happy with it. And we are not.
Okay, Honourable Member, for
whoever
you object
to. Honourable Member, please. Yeah, I think Mr. Consider. That some universities are not in a position to be forced to offer something, you know, in this area. And universities are really struggling with their primary mandate in many areas. So I find it quite bizarre, to be quite honest with you.
Are you okay?
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Yes, I wanted to check also that the reason is that universities can offer both academic and technical services. So if the minister feels in the environment of a particular university, it will be in the best interest of the community to add the technical dimension. Do we think that is a best thing? If that happens, it is in the interest of the community. Remember where we come from. Is that necessarily a harmful thing to the law? For me, I mean, it could benefit the community.
So are you objecting?
No, I agree with you if that is what it means.
Jackson, I just wanted to ask, what is the current position? I am convinced that there will be institutions that we already have this right. So I think in view of the whole, can I say, rearrangement of the higher education system, it would be necessary because the state must look at available resources, at infrastructure, the location of the infrastructure in various areas, etc., and then say it's not going to be sound financial governance or planning if we again build another TVET college in that area, but we rather ask the University of Mpumalanga to offer this and that course or whatever. So I think what we need to understand is what is the contractor, that we make sure that this is actually meant to regularize perhaps practices that we have at present on, you know, in the system. Thank you. Well, I would support if they can just explain to us what the intention was and, you know, if this is what it is all about. Thank you.
I will now allow the department to give an explanation on what informs this thinking and what is the presentation of this.
No, thank you, Chair. If we go back to our white paper on post-education and training, and if we look at the amendments in this particular legislation, it is linked to the integration of the higher education and training system. At the moment, the de facto situation is that a number of institutions are, via agreement with seekers, offering OQSF qualifications. Noting that firstly they have to be accredited by the QCP to offer those particular programs, but secondly, the legislation didn't allow them to offer it. So in a way there was a question of whether they were acting legally within the constitution itself because of the higher education sub-framework, the OQSF. So in terms of the white paper, there has been an opening up about cross-institutional cross-pollination as well as the issue of differentiation. Now, this means that a higher education institution can approach the minister and say, look, we do have a capability, capacity, etc., to identify us. Because remember, the issue is that any particular program will have to come with funding for. So I think that's the critical issues. But also, the sense is that there are some institutions that, in terms of the quality, etc., and Dr. Buckley can come in, the issue is towards the differentiated particular aspect. And as Honorable Member Killian rightly explained about access, space, distance, rather than setting up another particular institution. And normally our institutions are quite creative, that they've been offering these particular programs, sometimes under entities that they establish, which in itself can lead to problem because according to the constitution, they're a juristic person, and it's not a university. So this allows those practices that have been happening also to particularly. So the main answer here is the policy issue in terms of the white paper.
The issue of Section 29 obviously also comes into play with the case earlier on in the way in the Development Act there is no reference to a public institution that can provide skills qualifications, certain occupational qualifications. The white paper, when it deals with the issue of the skills and the strategic goals, in paragraph 8.4, it specifically indicates that the universities, and I've got it, and I can read it to the committees, but it specifically provides that the skills qualifications will be made available, particularly through universities and TV colleges. That's the wording of the Act. Now, the white paper. Now, the legislation must obviously accommodate it in dealing with it. Institutions, your public institutions, are currently divided between what is on only two sub-frameworks, that of higher education and that of general tertiary education, which is more in the two sub-frameworks is dealing with the institutional type of universities when it comes to higher education sub-framework, and when it comes to general and further, it is within the TVET colleges. Now, the TVET colleges in the Continuing Education Training Act, we got a similar provision
where a TVET college can provide also qualification. That in higher education, that provision has not been included as yet. And in order to comply with that, it is critical. And also the issue of your private fuse providers. Currently, we are struggling to register them because of the fact that there are no identified public institutions. If this legislation comes into place, then we've got a legal provision also to enforce that provision, because then it can be identified that it is out of a comparable public institution. In the current scenario, if you take them to court, of course, it's a very public institution. Why must they register? Because there is no comparability, and therefore there can't be any. And the approach that is taken is that this is not necessary for a university, but a university identified by the ministry in policy. Classificated before, but probably it will not affect all the universities, but specific universities. It might be a university like UNITA, which already offers a number of qualifications, which is falling within the sub-framework of graduation occupations, that it will also open up a number of qualifications that are offered by the universities of trade and occupations. In practice, we've also got a situation that the universities are creating separate legal entities to actually offer these qualifications. Those legal entities are not public institutions. They are private. They are separate from the university, and therefore that cannot be as a justification. It must be the institution, the public institution, that can be the institution to which that comparability that the constitution refers to must be benchmarked for that.
Dr. Parker?
And then,
I think it's just related very quickly to this issue of the mask. And I don't think there was full agreement that it should be masked. But the point around that there should be some universities that offer these kinds of qualifications, otherwise they can't have the comparability. And I'm just wondering if this can be turned around a little bit, because what it looks like is that the ministry will independently identify an institution, and you say that one might serve, that's not the intention either, isn't it? It's about an institution. So I'm not a legal person. But I know we had a long discussion about whether it should be not or made, but the issue is if it's made and it could be number. Yes. So perhaps it is with agreement of the minute.
I think this has been a very enlightening and interesting discussion. Although, I mean, I must say to yourself, Chair, to Dr. Parker, I think that the word mask does make it problematic in and of itself. Therefore, I agree that there can be some modification that's made. Perhaps, say, may, with the agreement of the minister, I think that would be fine. And therefore, it would seek to achieve the outcomes I think that the department has been trying to achieve.
Dropping the sword altogether,
I can see the need for a mechanism. If this is correctly worded, I doubt. Because there seems to be a need for some other body to set an official control, and then secondly, they should be referenced to with a necessary budget and provision and extra capital. It is understood because I don't see it. Now, then we get to the issue of the money. Now, clearly, once the processes have been followed and the institution is aware that they will be the necessary provision of the program, then it must become a must.
Mm.
But I think what we need is a step for the minister to just make sure that the whole matter is just duly consulted and that the institution is aware that in the broader interest of higher education is the need for this type of program to sub-frame the deliver that in that institution. We get the need that we're aware of. So can we not ask for rewording of the course? Yes.
Right, Mr. Barton?
As a result of a forced offering. That is my problem. So, if this could work out in whatever shape or form, but it must be to the best interest of the university and for public good. It mustn't, and for public good, cover higher education. So it mustn't look like we can just in some way feel that this university must offer this without having done due diligence. That's my point. The system at the end of the day has to search protect its offering, justify its offering, and realign its offering to credibly mesh itself against itself. That is why we allowed you all those definitions that you gave us. So now don't confuse us strategically. That's what I'm saying. I don't have a proposal. That's what I'm saying.
Can I just have my ask a question? Will the Honourable Mbaza not support my principal request that we consider rewording, because we all understand it must be in the public for the public good, etc. It must be, noting that we have budgetary constraints as a country, etc. That noting that there must be due consultation and all of that. But in the end, somebody must take this ball and run with it. And the minister has the political responsibility. So therefore, once he's gone through a process, it must happen. So can we not just reword it to reflect that? And then I would like to ask my honourable colleague if he won't support that.
Looks to me that forcing universities to teach at levels below their, the faculty level, which they're designed to teach, to me will engender quite a big backlash from the university sector. I think this is not wise. It's not wise. They can teach CVET courses if they wish to already, and many of them do.
I really think very few of the committee should think carefully about this. It's not a wise move. It's a move that could create problems in the university. I still oppose it strongly, and I don't think it can be modified.
Okay, I'm sure the department has been the legal guru near the city on the working of the clause. Okay, honourable member,
they should limit it, but put it in such a way that it becomes an official tool of the process.
So you see, now you
but in politics, we talk about the concept of resources. You have to think about it.
If there is a movement that the intended or the ideal situation for this is to realign all sorts of requests so as to cover as well as the real part. I agree with that, but the problem is when our main system is the one that spearheads the agreement, because then you are affecting the way the system is supposed to run itself. You must remember, on top of the political authority, there is the autonomy. And the autonomy doesn't fight with the process of that. It is an agreement. This does not achieve an agreement the way it's played here. That's all we're asking out of
you. Okay, guys. Yeah. You see, the members are really strongly that this one has got to be reworked. I'm sure you will be listening carefully. And then, who is going to rework it so that we can come back and we satisfy ourselves on the reworked section?
Yeah, no, okay. We'll take all those points into account. And we'll rework that particular issue in terms of the policy. But I just want to provide some information to members. Remember that the RPS that goes from level 1 to level 12, level 10. So it's not limited to, we've got qualifications at level 9, we've got qualifications at level 8 on OQSF. Now, part of the issue is, if you don't find a provisioning issue, we may have to look at a policy process to be able to have that subframe working to look at the new institutional forms totally that will cover that particular subframe. But we'll work with it in terms of the comments that members are making, and we will have to see how the policy process then unfolds. I must also just indicate that the strong point under this clause is that it has to be done under Section 3, which provides a very strong policy
guidance.
A consultation process. Thank you. But we will do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been raising my hand. I just wanted to check because, like Professor Bozzoli does say, that this is happening in universities about the issue of if universities offer skills, it could affect startups. But I mean, when they are doing the technical but separately, like it was very technical. The major part is not doing academic, but as part of its section, there is other section that is offering technical and which is called very technical. I thought it is under the administration of that, and it is just separating the sector of technical skills that are offered there vis-a-vis the academic ones that are there in the main campus. Is this not kind of protecting the standards of academic work that is done separate from the skills studies done in Czech, in this technical. This is just a point that I want to understand for myself.
That was the question. Professor Simango.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I would love to support Honorable Kekana really strongly, because this is how these things started. I think UNISA was in the forefront of introducing the certificate course. There was a feeling that there were people already in business or in the market who needed certain skills but did not have qualifications to go to university. We started at UNISA with people in trade. There were people who were running shops they did not have any accounting skills, and they would take a certificate course which was not recognized by the Department of Education, but they would get the required skills so that they at least have an idea of what is happening as far as accounting is concerned. Then the second faculty at UNISA was theology. They identified many lay teachers, especially from the non-formal churches, and they wanted to help them with the skills of reading the Bible, explaining theology and things like that. So they took these degree courses. Now, they have become very popular. Many universities, not all, are offering these certificate courses, but they are not recognized. So I was just supporting him. It is quite right. That's how it originated.
Okay.
No problem in my mind with universities offering these courses. Almost all of them do. The problem is the minister telling them to offer the courses. That is the problem. The word must is the problem. That the minister should not be able to say to a university, from now on you must offer Carpentry 101. That is not how university system works in the past, and it should not be how it works in the future. The whole point of the law is to be a facilitative thing rather than a directive thing. And I think that is the only problem. As far as LibTech is concerned, LibTech no longer exists. LibTechnicon is now part of UJ and has been closed, and one only has universities of technology now. There aren't any technicons.
Okay.
We were told at the beginning of this that almost proposals have been made by CHE. But we have to protect the way we work as the development. Otherwise, I might also want that my student demand to be constructed. The fees must fall.
Okay.
You
don't
have to
comply with
the
All right. So we are all agreeing that this must be reworked, but how long will it take you to rework? But I'm sure that as you see here, you can't reach up so that
you can have it next week. So look at next week, then when you come back to the level of
these are very complex issues, and I think when one should have slightly more time than just a few minutes.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Now let's look at the time. It's already 1 o'clock. I promise you lunch break. Indeed, I'm
Okay, let's go.